morning. May it please the court, I'm Martin Whitaker here on behalf of the plaintiff and the appellant, Glenn Hepperman. This case comes to the appellate court, to the circuit court, after a four-day jury trial in front of Judge Leinenweber. The case was brought against two defendants, the City College of Chicago, District 508, the Board of Trustees of District 508, and an individual employed at Malcolm X College, one of their constituent colleges, Dan Davis. After that jury trial, the jury rendered a verdict in favor of my client, Mr. Hepperman, on his fraud claim against Mr. Davis, and entered a verdict as well in favor of Mr. Hepperman on the Fair Labor Standards Act claim, the minimum wage and overtime wage claim against City Colleges, and rendered a verdict in City College's favor on the Title VII claim. The issues before this court today are whether Judge Leinenweber's subsequent reversal of the jury verdict and the subsequent judgment that he entered on the fraud claim was proper, and whether the jury was properly instructed on the Title VII claim.
Mr. Whitaker, let me tell you what troubles me about this case. As I understand your argument on this fraud claim, you are saying that Judge Leinenweber made a mistake to look at the form that Mr. Hepperman signed in August, which clearly said that employment has to be approved by the Board of Trustees, because he had been working from March at least until August, and then actually on into October. But as of August, he's got the form in front of him. But there is this not entirely clear testimony about whether he filled out an application back in March when he was meeting with Mr. Davis. He says he did fill out an application. He doesn't remember if it was an official one. The copy seems to have disappeared, and so on. But fraud claims are subject to a heightened standard of proof. And I'm concerned that by failing to get into the record that this was some sort of odd or non-standard application, even if Judge Leinenweber made a technical mistake to look only at the August form, why wasn't he basically correct to say that if a form was filled out at all, any reliance Mr. Hepperman may have had on Mr. Davis's statements would not have been reasonable?
Because, Judge Wood, the existence of a form is immaterial to the issue whether the reliance is vitiated.
Well, why is that? I mean, it seems to me if he had signed the August form in March, and we all knew that, and it was right there in the record, our case law suggests that any reliance he may have had on statements by Mr. Davis that only he was in charge of hiring would have been unreasonable, because it said in black and white on the form that's not so.
Because, if I may finish the point, the existence of a form is immaterial to the question. It's the existence and his looking at the language. It's not whether there's a piece of paper in front of him. It's what does it say. And if there is a heightened standard of proof for fraud claims, and proving each element of a fraud claim, they're making an issue of a form that they had. The only testimony in the record is he got this form in March, one of the first interviews he had with Mr. Davis, gave it to Mr. Davis. The sole custodian of the sole form is Mr. Davis. This March form, we don't know what it says because it doesn't exist, so Mr. Davis and City College is making an issue of this evidence, diminishes, and that's not the right way to say it, helps Mr. Hepperman's case, helps him achieve and overcome that heightened burden of proof, because the only inference, as a matter of law, not as a matter of argument, not as a matter of rhetoric, as a matter of law, the only conclusion that can be drawn from the non-existence of that form, the losing of the language, is that it didn't contain this reliance vitiating boilerplate language.
So would you be saying that they, at that point, as soon as he testifies to the effect of his conversations in March with Mr. Davis, the burden of at least production shifted to the colleges, to the board, to show that, in fact, reliance would have been unreasonable?
I'm not sure it's a matter of shifting burdens or not. It's a matter of what proof, what evidence is before the jury on this issue, and the only evidence the only evidence before the jury is, I had a form, I don't remember what it says, I don't remember if it was like the one that you've seen later in August when I've been strung along for 6 months. It was there, I got to tell you, I remember doing it. I submitted a tax form, I think there was an application, I don't remember what it says. And there's a whole give and take on cross-examination because it came out on City College's cross-examination, but they asked, well, what'd you do with it? Said, I don't keep application form. An application is something you give in. Mr. Davis has it. He hasn't produced it. The only thing that a jury can conclude as a matter of law and as a matter of practical inference, too, is that boilerplate language, the exculpatory, don't trust me about
did the jury or the judge decide that your client was entitled to minimum wage?
I'm sorry, Judge Posner, I didn't hear.
Did the judge or jury decide your client was entitled to minimum wage?
The jury did.
Jury all
All claims were submitted to the jury. Judge Leinenweber gave the liquidated damages, the double damages on our post-trial motion. Taking up the theme.
So he must have thought there was some sort of contract.
Judge Leinenweber?
Yeah.
Yes. I don't remember. I dismissed out the contract claim, but we went through summary judgment.
What I mean is, if you agree to work for nothing, you're not entitled to minimum wage.
Exactly.
So Judge Leinenweber must have thought that your client had been hired.
I think that whether he thought it or not, that's just established as a matter of law. The Fair Labor Standards Act verdict and judgment stands, and there was a contract of employment.
Couldn't the judge consistently hold, maybe this is threading the needle too finely, but couldn't he hold that the disclaimer language was ineffective to cancel an obligation by the college to pay your client, but on the other hand, it would negate fraud because it would warn Hefferman that he'd be taking a big risk if he relied on this?
I think that's what Judge Leinenweber wanted to do, and maybe he was threading the needle finally, but maybe he wasn't as nimble as he ought to be. But it still doesn't overcome the fact that there is two instruments by which we brought the claim, the fraud and the contract-like claim to the Fair Labor Standards Act. The title of wages is a matter of law, and it was a matter of his agreement with City Colleges and its agent, Mr. Davis. But fraud is a more basic, more elemental claim, after all, too. He worked. The tort claim of fraud is designed to make sure that people who are abused by someone who lies to them get relief. The timing is important with that basic point in mind. He worked fully, 5 months, March through August, worked hard. The jury gave him more wages than I argued for in my closing. There's just no dispute that he put in a lot of time, and before August, this form was dated August 27th. And did it solely on the expectation that he's going to get this wonderful new career advancing position that had been promised to him.
When did he expect to get it? I mean, he's working, I don't know under what auspices, but at some point he's not getting a paycheck. I know he's been asking for money, but at what point did he think the job began? Not October, whatever it is, 9th or something.
Last week of March, Judge Mahan, I apologize for jumping in, but this is clear. This is absolutely clear because the interviews take place in the month of March. The Tribune article is in the first week of April when the Tribune reporter writes, here we have a white man employed at Malcolm X College, he's just taken a job. And Mr. Hefferman's testimony on this point, it's cited in my briefs, I won't bother to fish it out because it is cited precisely. You're my man. This is in March, Mr. Davis says to Mr. Hefferman. You're my man. Get to work. We'll get you on the payroll next week.
go get them.
Well, this is a coaching job, right?
Exactly.
I mean, he didn't expect the physical education instructor job until October.
That's right. He's still working, he's doing moonlighting job as a coaching job in March, but the physical education job, which is also told to him, you're on in March, but that's the next academic term, which begins September of the next year. But the promise of the hiring to both jobs occurs simultaneously in the spring when he's hired and when he immediately begins work.
Now, if he had remained, I guess he had the option of remaining, he would have been the coach, but not a teacher. Is that right?
I'm confused and a little bemused by your remarks, Judge Mannion, about his choice to remain.
Well, he left. I mean, I don't know when you said how he's fired or whatever, but he did not get the teaching job.
That's correct.
But would he have, if he had stayed there, would he have still gotten the coaching job?
Yes, he would have gotten the coaching job and would be there today, too, if he'd gotten a paycheck before he had to sue. I see I'm into my rebuttal time.
Okay, do you want to reserve that, or you want to take it?
I'll just take one.
Use it up?
30 seconds, and hope I have about 2 minutes left afterwards. To reiterate, and I don't want to be fatuous, but I remind the court that we're here on the appealing the adverse Title VII verdict, too. The instruction that we've appealed, I don't think, could be possibly more confusing. You cannot tell.
Yeah, but no, it's not. It was confusing, but there were clear instructions surrounding it, so unlikely to have had any effect.
Well, I respectfully, Judge Posner, I don't think that you can tell seven lay people do this, decide whether he was fired with discriminatory intent or whether he failed to be hired with discriminatory intent, but then again, only consider the firing or only consider the failed.
Now, what about the closing argument? Did you make clear in your closing argument that it could be hiring or firing?
I don't recall whether I talked specifically about the theories on that instruction. I wanted to avoid the argument in my closing. I suspect that I didn't highlight the theories about the Title VII discrimination in my closing argument, but I don't know, honestly.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Weaver. Mr. Weir?
The matter is brought before the court seeking to overturn the judgment of the district court, which held as a matter of law after considering all the evidence that the appellant failed to prove certain essential elements of fraud. First, it has to be untrue, and then...
What's so strange about it, maybe I'm being simple-minded, but as I look at Judge Leinweber's discussion, looking at page 8 of the appendix, plaintiff's brief, page 9, rather. Last paragraph. Plaintiff relies on the fact Davis told me the authority to hire him, which was not true. But plaintiff could not reasonably rely on this alleged oral statement when the written application he signed and submitted contradicted the oral statement. What puzzles me is, if this is correct, what the judge said, How could Hefferman get a judgment for wages?
Well, Your
it
Honor,
must be that somehow Davis said to him somehow bound the college, or else, right?
I read the transcript, Your Honor. I did not try the case. Mr. Lee tried the case, the underlying case. Perhaps when he comes up, he could answer that particular question for you. But as a practical matter, I could see how when Mr. Davis, when there was a controversy over whether or not Mr. Hefferman really felt that he was mistaken and had agreed to pay him for this preseason work that was traditionally voluntary by people, that he went out of his way to try to get him paid on a voucher system, and with that voucher system, which identified dates going back to the date that Mr. Hefferman said in March, then with that piece of evidence, it appears as though he really was working on a paid basis from the date in March.
But, you know, the problem with your brief is that you completely ignore in your brief the fact that Mr. Hefferman prevailed on his basic FLSA claim. He, of course, failed on the retaliation claim, but he prevailed, you don't even mention that part of the verdict. And so, you know, we don't get any assistance reconciling these things. And the other thing that bothers me about that same excerpt from Judge Leinenweber's oral remarks is I can't tell what written application he's talking about, because if he's talking about the August written application, that's months after Mr. Hefferman has been working, and we still are left with a significant period of time during which reliance may have been absolutely justifiable. This is, after all, Rule 50 review. We have to take everything in the light most favorable to the jury's findings. You know, the day for credibility is over. It has to be done as a matter of law, and I'm quite concerned about the failure of your clients to focus on the March application, which of course normally would have been in the custody of the employer. People don't fill out job applications and keep them themselves.
Yes. Your Honor, Mr. Davis said Mr. Hefferman filled in no application at that time. This was a voluntary period.
Well, so of course there couldn't have been any reliance,
so he
if
had
that
none.
Was true. It, well, but
Mr. Hefferman said he did.
Listen to where that takes you, though. If, in fact, Mr. Davis's account is correct, then there was certainly no language in a written application in March on which Mr. Hefferman should have actually taken, you know, that he should have looked at and that would have destroyed reliance, right? There's
but,
nothing.
But there was one that was sent by Mr. Hefferman by his testimony on April 8th to Dr. Ferdina Williamson, the Dean of Continuing Education. That was less than 2 weeks after he supposedly started. Sent an application with a letter to her asking for consideration as a teacher in physical education or a counseling position.
But that's not relating to the coaching position. We do have two issues here, and as I understand the jury's verdict on the FLSA claim, that was about the job he performed as coach.
Yes.
So let's just focus on that for the moment.
Okay. On the coaching job, Your Honor, he got the job. No matter what you call the job, even though it was a question over whether or not there was a contractual agreement to pay him initially, he was the head basketball coach. You could call him bench coach, whatever you wanted to call him. He got that job. He was the top person. He put the team together. He worked with them, supposedly on a voluntary basis, but he was the coach.
But our issue here is whether Judge Leinenweber committed error in granting judgment as a matter of law on the fraud claim. And he seems to have relied on some written application that wasn't in anybody's possession, that's just not there as of March.
No, I think he relied upon the one that was in August based upon testimony by Mr. Hefferman that he had filled in not only one in March, but another one 2 weeks later.
For a
another
different
one
job, and he says he doesn't know if it was an official one in March in the transcript.
No,
yes,
I don't.
He does. He says there was a tax form and a job application. Also, I don't know if it was an official one.
But in addition to that, he went down to see Mr. Eggenhausen, who was the human rights director, and then asked Mr. Eggenhausen for consideration for the same job that he states
to be.
Yeah, the same job, the physical education.
No, see, you're talking about the other job. That's not what the JMOL is about.
Well, he did get the coaching job. There was nothing false about that. The statement was not false. He promised him the coaching job. He got the head coaching job. He was hired for that. And there was nothing false about the pay. He was paid, albeit late and because of a lot of bureaucratic problems that Mr. Davis had no control over. It was school problems with their pay system.
What was the fraud about then?
Well, the allegation was that he was promised the head coaching job, the pay for that position in the preseason, and a teaching position.
So they're in tandem
tenure.
As far as the fraud is concerned, based on that claim?
Yes. Well, the first two are clearly, they're not false. He got the coaching
but
job.
He had to get his pay.
No, Your Honor, it was tendered before the lawsuit.
Considerably less than what he got under the FLSA, I might add.
Well, there was an agreement that happened between the two parties when they found out about the disagreement. And Mr. Hefferman and Mr. Davis worked out something saying, what is your starting date? He was trying to accommodate him to keep down conflict. Mr. Hefferman said March 23rd. They then took a calendar, computed the times, the dates, added, and that's where Mr. Davis prepared that voucher. a per diem voucher to try to get him paid to satisfy him so that he could keep coaching. He filled in this per diem voucher with all those dates, which ended up being a basis for something in the wage claim. But that's how they arrived at the $4,250 amount, which was satisfactory, both of them agreed. Then Mr. Davis got the amount in a check. Eventually, it went to Mr. Hefferman. And that was before
not,
the
suit. Was not accepted by him, right?
Not accepted, but it was sent to him before the lawsuit was filed, Your Honor. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Ware.
You're welcome.
Mr. Lee?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kevin Lee, and I represent Defendant City Colleges of Chicago and Dan Davis. With respect to this matter, as Mr. Whitaker indicated, it's divided into two claims on the appeal, and my portion is just to address the jury instruction, which is alleged to have been error on the Title VII claim. Essentially, the defendant's instruction 15B was a business judgment defense instruction, which consisted of two paragraphs, which state that if defendant had a valid business decision for not hiring Hefferman for the position he sought, the jury should not second guess or dissect that decision. Now, he does not argue that the law does not give the employer the latitude to make a valid business decision, only that this instruction is in conflict on appeal with another instruction. However, in order to analyze this, we need to look at what it is that he objected to. And this is what he said at the time of the trial, verbatim. Mr. Whitaker, Your Honor. The court, yes. Mr. Whitaker, because I don't think that, although Your Honor has noted my objections to the two instructions that you have accepted that were tendered by the defendant, I don't think I noted one of my objections to one of them. The pro-offered and now accepted defendant's instruction number 15B included the language in substance that you must not second-guess the defendant's decision. I think that language amounts to a peremptory direction from this court, and I think it is improper. Now, the objection at trial specifically argues the point of second-guessing the jury and that that language is peremptory and improper. We can only assume that by improper, counsel means that this was not an accurate statement of the law. If anything else was meant, it certainly is not clear. However, on appeal, counsel is not making the same argument that he made at the trial court level. He is now attempting to expand the argument and make a new argument that the failure to reference the firing in that instruction caused the jury not to consider Hefferman's firing. Now, you may disagree that he's making a different argument now than he was in the trial court. You're certainly free to do that. But I ask you, why is it that we can have this debate about what the argument was that he was making? It is because his objection was not made with sufficient clarity to put the court on notice as to exactly what his problem was with the jury instruction. Pursuant to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 51, it is incumbent upon the party making the objection to state distinctly the matter objected to and the grounds for the objection. Now, in the absence of this information, how can the court cure a problem with an instruction if there is a valid objection?
Well, essentially, you're just saying he's waived the argument that he's now making, and if that's what the record shows, perhaps he has. We wouldn't even need to worry about it. It's right or wrong, prejudicial, right?
Correct. And assuming that he made a valid objection, assuming that he did not waive it, even if we come to that point, as Judge Posner pointed out, in several other parts of the instructions, it clearly references what the standard is on Title VII, and his firing claim is clearly enunciated in the other instruction which he tendered and which the court accepted. So even if there was some problem with this instruction, which I assert that there wasn't, it would have been cured. It would have been harmless because the other instructions adequately address it. And ultimately, the question is, when you construe all of the jury instructions in their entirety, were they sufficient to correctly inform the jury of the applicable law? And if you ask that question, we believe that they were. And therefore, the decision of Judge Leinenweber with respect to the jury instruction on the Title VII should be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Whitaker, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
That would be ample time for a few things I have to say. I must correct something that Mr. Ware said, told the panel. He represented that the partial payment that was tendered to Mr. Hefferman came before the suit was filed. It did not. Patrick's Day 2001, we filed suit in January 2000. The tender didn't come, and it's in JX16, one of the exhibits that's been tendered in the exhibit books, Your Honor. It came months after we filed the suit. Mr. Hefferman did have to file suit before he got a thin dime from anyone on the defense side. There is nothing, nothing in the record prior to August 27th that in any way vitiates Mr. Hefferman's reliance on the promises he testified Mr. Davis made to him in March of 1999. You're going to get this job, it's going to be tenure track, and I must correct another representation that Mr. Ware made. The promise about the basketball coaching position is not a matter of the title, it's a matter of the pay. You're going to be paid when you do your work. That's untrue, and it's irrebuttably untrue in light of the FLSA verdict. He wasn't paid. That's what was promised. It was false. There is nothing in the record that vitiates his reliance, his hard work, for the months between his hiring in March and this first form that he got in August of that same year. And the final remark I'd make is this boilerplate clause appears in every application. It, in and of itself, doesn't vitiate reliance after that, although he did testify that he's beginning to see the handwriting on the wall by about early September. Every application with an institutional employer is going to have similar language, but you rely on the person you're dealing with, your immediate supervisor, to tell you one way or the other whether you're hired or not. My red light is on.
Okay, thank you very much to both sides.